Welcome to a new episode of the Digging a Hole podcast, the legal theory podcast. David Schleicher, me, and Sam Moyne talk about legal theory. But this is a special episode. This is not any ordinary episode. This is a special post-election episode where we're going to talk about all things election 2020. Sam, who's coming to join us?
David, I'm excited. Today we've got Ross Douthat of the New York Times joining us. And never fear, because we do, by the end of the podcast, get back to the law and even talk about the Supreme Court for a bit. So let's get into it.
And one quick thing, everyone. There may be a few small audio issues with some of the recording from this episode. Our apologies in advance. So with that, let's get to it.
All right. So this week we're going way off brand, not going to talk about legal theory unless we own the fact that law is always politics by other means. And we're going to, bat around the topic of the recent national elections. And no one could, join us who would be better to do so than our friend Ross Douthat, who is an occasional colleague. This year, he's a senior fellow at our Jackson Institute. I believe you dabble in journalism sometimes.
I have a little red blog on an obscure Brooklyn-based website. Yes.
Okay. Excellent. So what we want to do today is just to kind of discuss the election. And David and I have chatted with one another that this is an amazing set of results, which have led everyone's priors to seem like they're confirmed. And I've noticed you running a few victory laps on Twitter and so forth. So what do you think this election proved about your interpretation of Donald Trump's presidency? And what did it, challenge? That's kind of where we want to begin.
Well, let's go in reverse, because I'll start with the non-victory lap, I guess. And thanks for having me on, by the way. I've heard this is the up and coming podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
Everyone, yeah. So
it's on the precipice of.
I hope startup. I'm getting in the pre-electric phase, I guess.
There you go. You're like kombucha before it was a thing.
That's right. That's right. So the thing, let's start with what I think I got wrong, which is something I got wrong all through the Trump era, which is that, I always expected at some point the combination of Trump's unpopularity and incapacities as president, and the fact that he's obviously a pretty horrible person, would have a big political cost for the GOP. So I expected that to happen in 2016. I remember writing columns with titles like "The Bonfire of the Republicans" during the Access Hollywood stuff. When Trump was falling back by like 12 points in the polls to Hillary Clinton. And then I expected it to some extent again this time, between, the coronavirus, the economic shocks, the basic fact that Trump was so unpopular and the Democrats nominated their most moderate candidate. I would not have been surprised at all if Biden had won by 9 or 10 points and Democrats had taken the Senate. And certainly, if you'd asked me like a few weeks out, I would have predicted something like that. There was a little bit of tightening in the polls just before the election, so I probably wouldn't have made that kind of bold prediction right before the election itself. But I was surprised by how close it was. I was surprised that Republicans gained as many seats as they did in the House. I wasn't totally surprised that Susan Collins hung on in Maine, but I was surprised by how easily she hung on. So generally, we went through 4 years of the Trump era where I consistently predicted that he would lose in the primary and the general election, and he did lose this time, seemingly, but he never brought the Republican Party back to the kind of debacle that it experienced in 2008, which was sort of what I thought was the biggest political risk that Republicans took in supporting him. So I got that wrong. Should we pause or should I then say what I got right?
So, I mean, I just want to quickly ask you, so how do you explain that? I think the story I would use to explain that is that that if you don't break from your party and you stay in party camps, as the Republicans have stayed attached to Trump, there's a limit to your downside. And the thing that made 2008 different from this election is that the Republicans genuinely kind of got fed up with George Bush and his popularity really fell. But as long as they kind of stay aligned, that polarization is sufficiently powerful that there's just a limited downside in modern American politics. Do you think that's right, wrong, or what?
I think that's plausible. But I mean, it's still a little weird, right? Because George W. Bush was incredibly popular with Republicans. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say that a failed war in the Middle East and financial meltdown. And Bush's numbers with Republicans were bad before the financial meltdown. Now, the scale of Obama's victory over McCain was clearly goosed by the meltdown, but there was more abandonment of Bush just over Iraq than there has been of Trump over COVID. And, you know, some of that does reflect the fact that the CARES Act and other moves we made sort of blunted the impact of the coronavirus on the economy and on a lot of people's everyday lives. And obviously, you know, the people who look at this and say, oh, it's an act of God that Trump couldn't do anything about, I think they're wrong. But the evidence from like Europe at the moment seems to suggest they aren't entirely wrong. So there's a lot of things going on. But I guess, yeah, I think that's plausible. But it's still striking that Republicans were more bonded to Trump seemingly than to Bush, even though at his peak, Bush was so much more popular than Trump and was better liked by a much broader section of Republicans and independents than Trump ever has been. I mean, I think, you know, part of what I think happened is that what I was wrong about was very specific to Trump. And part of the reasons he held on as well as he did had to do with things that then I do think I am right about, right? So the victory lap part of this is, you know, I mean, for 12, 14 years, I and many others, but, you know, I was sort of associated with this idea early on, have been arguing that the Republican Party has a perfectly reasonable future as a kind of populist formation in American politics that unites sort of middle and working class voters and can win not just white voters, but Hispanics and African Americans and recent immigrants from Asia on a sort of populist platform that isn't necessarily, you know, in favor of comprehensive immigration reform and the things that sort of a lot of centrists assume that Republicans needed to favor to be competitive with minorities. And, you know, I mean, Trump did not like clean up with minority voters, but he improved his standing with them to an extent that probably shouldn't have surprised people who were following the polls, but clearly did surprise people. And, you know, that, and he didn't go sort of all in, he didn't do a lot of the populist things that he promised on, you know, infrastructure bills and so on. He did try and repeal Obamacare. But at the same time, he was a populist insofar as he abandoned the, you know, Romney-Ryan plans to cut Medicare. He was certainly a populist on monetary policy, where he abandoned sort of Republican inflation hawkishness. So there was sort of more pro-worker policy under Trump in a weird way than there would have been maybe under McCain or Romney. And that combined with sort of this larger drift in American politics sufficed to let him win, you know, to hold his white working class base and add to it with middle class minorities, even though, you know, he's a bigot and a creep, right? And then the other thing is that, you know, one of my consistent arguments in my position as a columnist who writes mostly for liberals is that lots of people don't like liberalism, and they don't like it not because they have some consistent and clear alternative to it, but because they don't trust sort of the consolidation of liberal power over, you know, universities, the mass media, you know, something that's been a truth of American life for a long time, but has become more of a truth, I think, over the last 10 years. And voting for Republicans is a way to sort of vote against consolidated liberal power, and people do it. And they do it even under pandemic conditions. They do it even when they don't want to say that they're doing it. There really were some shy Trump voters, mostly seemingly, you know, upper middle class suburban males, you know.
I personally am deeply objectionable, so I understand this.
So, so those are my two, you know, there's sort of a drift towards a working class conservatism that is strong enough, even, you know, or has been accelerated maybe by Trump. We can argue about his distinctives. And, you know, liberalism generally globally and in the United States has lost a certain amount of political appeal as it has consolidated its cultural power, I would say. And that's just like, and that helps keep politics polarized even in conditions when you wouldn't expect it to be.
So we definitely want to make the prospects of a conservative populism or working class movement or party kind of the main event of this episode. But I want to go back and maybe start with the liberal side, because I also was flummoxed by the results from the left. I thought it was going to be a much more decisive election, you know, which was going to be cause for some concern. And notwithstanding, you know, this, you know, David's point about polarization, I'm still amazed that for 4 years, the liberal strategy was not to look, let's say, inwards, not to revisit much in the way of policy, some noises, but really to pursue a kind of delegitimation strategy. And because all I read is your paper, you know, I don't even, you know, watch Fox, you know, once in the greatest while. I was shocked that the election was so close. So can you comment on whether you think the delegitimation strategy, basically daring Americans to vote for Trump again and shaming them for having done so the first time, was that just a version of the polarization thesis, or is it something new? Because to me, I've not seen it in politics in my lifetime, that kind of intensity in mainstream media and social media of just othering the opposition in a way that I thought would have, you know, would allow the Democrats to reap benefits for a centrist outcome. And
He sort of did,
but not really. He won, but Joe Biden won barely. You know, I've been, you know, I mean, there are a lot of attacks on Twitter about, you know, those who worry about underperformance. But again, when you look below, especially at the House of Representatives, you know, it came out differently than we expected and than polls anticipated. So could you just kind of weigh in on whether delegitimation is just is explained by polarization? I mean, the failure of delegitimation, or whether it's that's shocking all by itself.
Yeah. I think to some extent, like you have, you know, I was not an admirer of the delegitimation strategy. It seemed to me that it was, you know, it made reasonable points about what was wrong with Trump. Like, it really is a bad thing to have a president who's like yelling at his attorney general to prosecute frivolous lawsuits on Twitter. Like, that's not good. But it turned that into a sort of grand narrative of, you know, 1930s style peril for American democracy that I didn't really think was justified. I think it prevented a certain, or it sort of substituted for a certain kind of centrist liberal self-critique about what went wrong in foreign policy and economic policy over the last 10 or 15 years. So in that sense, I guess I'm not surprised that it didn't work, because I thought it was bad, right? But that's you know, there's various fallacies woven into that kind of leap. I think there's like a balancing here, right? Where if you're thinking about, you know, what helped the Democratic Party win, because, you know, they did in fact win the presidency in the end. They did flip a bunch of states, and there was sort of an argument that I'll probably carry on at some point once the dust settles more from the election, that a woman named Laura Field from the Niskanen Center. Let me just check that's her name. Yeah, Laura Field from the Niskanen Center wrote a piece just before the election criticizing actually both you and I, Sam.
Correct.
For, you know, basically not acknowledging how important the idea of a capital R resistance was to sort of mobilizing and organizing movements and people who then ultimately helped. I mean, when she was writing it, I think she assumed it wouldn't be as close an election as it was, but, you know, who helped tip states away from Trump and helped limit his political capacities, his capacities to be as bad as he could have been. And I think you have to concede that some of that's true, right? That, like, there clearly Democratic Party in, you know, mobilizing large numbers of, let's say, especially white suburban women who are, you know, very politically active or potentially politically active to begin with against, you know, the specter of sort of misogynistic authoritarianism. There are benefits to, you know, having mass media sort of join ranks, close ranks against your political rivals. And, you know, I think it's totally plausible to me that, like, a state like Georgia doesn't flip without certain kinds of resistance organizing, right? That sort of the combination of, you know, Trump as white supremacist to help organize African-Americans and Trump as authoritarian threat to help organize white suburbanites. And, you know, you put those threats together, you get a higher level of alarm and voter turnout and so on that was, you know, in the end necessary to put Biden over the top. I'm just not at all sure that those benefits outweigh the costs of the approach, which, you know, include this, you know, sort of feeding this kind of anti-liberal permanent backlash that I'm describing, right? Where if you have this moment where, guess what, you know, every mainstream media outlet except Fox seems to be on the same side, and, you know, social media companies are censoring the president, and, you know, does that helps you get to some level of support, but it also probably convinces some people to say, screw you, I'm voting for Trump and I'm not going to tell anybody about it just because I don't like this apparent alliance of media and tech and the Democratic Party. You know, so there are just various, that's just one example, but there are various ways, I think, in which, you know, this kind of mentality was less helpful to Democrats than sort of more normal politics, right? Like the more abnormal things that Democrats did, the sort of focus on the Mueller investigation, the hopes placed in it, the focus on impeachment, even the way the Kavanaugh nomination battle played out. Those were all battles where the sort of resistance aspects of liberalism were really potent, and they were all battles that Democrats lost. Whereas the battles that Democrats won were the midterm election, where they basically ran on healthcare, and now the presidential election, where Biden ran on a return to normalcy and working across the aisle. And that sort of suggests maybe that boring meat and potatoes politics was more effective than delegitimation. But again,
I want to take that exact point and flip it on you a little bit on your victory lap, which is I'm very skeptical about the future of conservative populism. And the reason I'm skeptical is almost everything you just said, which is that the one thing this election stands for is the full mobilization of the professional classes against the Republican Party, right? So we saw this in the huge amount of money going to random losing Senate races, that if you were opposing a Republican, you could raise $1 trillion, you know, even if you have no chance of winning, if you're running in Kentucky or running in South Carolina or whatever. And a full embrace of conservative populism, I think, implies a renunciation of rich guys. So if conservative populism means anything, it means denying the Kochs, right? Like that's like the essential move of Douthatian kind of Ross and Rahan Republicanism.
It's Douthatian.
Douthatian.
Let's be clear here.
Douthat-esque. I'm not sure. It could go in a lot of directions. But it's the moving away from that and moving away from the professional classes and also moving into a social milieu that is famously unorganized, So from Bowling Alone to Deaths of Despair. And there aren't social institutions to turn excitement about Trump into long-run politics. G.W. Plunkett famously said, the reform is a morning glory, but the party is an old oak. And there aren't a lot of old oaks in white working class politics. And so it seems to me that your case for conservative populism or the future of conservative populism in a post-Trump world is about that there is a future in a politics that's without expertise, without money, and without organization. And maybe you can substitute for that with celebrity, but it's not obvious to me that that's so. So what is the case for conservative populism without Trump playing the role of able to excite to own the libs?
It's possible that you're right, and that conservative populism doesn't have, no conservatism right now has strong institutional support in the United States, right? I mean, in certain ways, it's telling that, the military was so hostile to Trump in various ways, the military being in certain ways the most right-wing prominent American institution, and even it was sort of more turned off by Trump than prior Republican presidents. But it's definitely true of conservative populism that it lacks, some of the support in highly politically motivated, well-educated suburbia that Reagan era conservatism enjoyed. And that the money in the Republican Party is, shall we say, at least mildly skeptical of populism. And your point about Trumpian celebrity, I think, is a really fair one, right? And I think I had a version of this in a column that I wrote, the column I wrote just after the election, that, it's possible that there just is something, with Trump, there's just this sort of trade-off where the nasty aspects of Trumpism alienate suburbanites, but the, celebrity populist sticking it to the elite side of Trumpism is necessary to get a lot of, sort of people who don't usually vote to go to the polls. And you're not going to recapture that with a Republican senator running on a populist platform in 4 years. So that's totally possible. And conservative populism in the US, manifests the problems of disorganization that you're describing and shares them with a lot of populist movements in other Western countries, right? I mean, what is the program of the Gilets Jaunes in France? Brexit provided a kind of focal point for conservative populism in the UK, but take away Brexit and it's not, or accomplished Brexit and it's not clear what the conservative populist agenda becomes, maybe sending more money to, Yorkshire. But anyway, so that's me agreeing with you to some extent. I think, though, what conservative populism has going for it is that we do live in a democracy of some sort, right? And the popularity of ideas matters. And the general conservative populist worldview, to the extent that you can define it, really just looks a lot more popular than alternative cuts on conservatism. There's these famous heat maps of where American voters actually lie. And, there's a little bit of bogusness in this, but if you divide it into quadrants, sort of socially conservative to socially liberal, economically populist to economically libertarian, there's just a huge number of Americans who are sort of mildly culturally conservative and mildly economically populist, and way more than there are who are like thoroughgoing libertarians. And the Republican Party has never been thoroughgoingly libertarian, right? Like, libertarians get a lot of grief, including from conservative populists. But, the Republican Party has always compromised with big government in 60 different ways. And in certain ways, I think you would say that, the populist challenge is figuring out how to take what Republicans are going to do to some extent, no matter what, and try and make it smarter and more focused and more successful. Like, the shape of public opinion means that if Republicans take power, they're never actually going to abolish entitlement programs and go down the Barry Goldwater list of ideas. They're going to do some kind of interest group based use of government power stuff no matter what. And so you need a cadre of people who can come into a Republican administration or sort of occupy conservative institutions who can make that more self-conscious and intelligent and coherent. And that's what, you know, one version of this was tried and failed with compassionate conservatism. Another version was tried and failed with Trumpism, but it was never really, you know, there was never really a coherent take on this from within the Trump White House itself. But one way or another, this is going to be tried again. And so the mission of people who write and think about ideas on the right is to try and figure out how to make it work, even with all the problems that you've described.
So, you know, I want to intervene in my best attempt at a kind of plaintive voice and, you know, ask really both of you, why couldn't and shouldn't the populist working class movement and party be a left-wing phenomenon rather than a white right-wing one? So I want to, you know, concede at the start that there's unexpected confirmation of some of your hopes in the election returns, and especially the idea, at least, although I guess we shouldn't rely too much on, you know, exit polling, that there could be a transracial class majority on the right. And, you know, I just did my own little postmortem in the New York Review that posted yesterday. And I completely concede, to me, it's scary that with Tucker Carlson and Josh Hawley and so forth, you imagine that the right is ahead of the game in certain ways ideologically in anticipating a right-wing, you know, populism. But, you know, where I come up short is that I can't exactly understand how it could ever succeed as an economic program on the right. So, you know, economic nationalism that would be through, you know, some form of trade policy, you know, restoring the manufacturing base, although admittedly Joe Biden talks about doing the same, just as a pipe dream. Historically, it's trade unions, you know, on the left that have organized the disorganized. It's not like I have a solution for reinvigorating them, but I don't see the right either having such a thing. So, you know, in the end, there won't be economics that the right can offer precisely for the kind of vision it can offer cultural unity, you know, and anti-elitist, you know, cultural memes, which, you know, it's long done and wax and wane in popularity. And so I guess I want to hear, you know, in somewhat more detail how this vindication either, you know, confirms or undermines the prospect after Trump has, you know, at least talked about various moves of a right-wing economic strategy that would be that would serve the majority of working people across racial lines, because my hypothesis is that it's not an available thing. So I want to hear why I'm wrong.
So I know, again, you may not be wrong, and I think it's also important to stress here that when we talk about a working class conservatism, it's still, notwithstanding these gains, you know, along the Rio Grande and in Florida and so on, it's still mostly a white working class conservatism. And it really does represent, you know, the more successful precincts of the white working class, right? So Republicans right now are doing very well among non-college educated voters who make like $80,000 or $90,000 a year, let's say. Which
Dylan
is
Dylan Matthews called them Buddy Garrity Republicans, which I thought was a genius turn.
Right. So they're right. And it's more than that, right? They aren't just doing well among sort of small business owners and people who own apple orchards outside, you know, Dubuque or something. They're also doing surprisingly well relative to 20 or 30 years ago among, like, you know, among sort of wage earners in those areas. But there still is a clear skew in the Republican vote towards people who are, you know, middle class to upper middle class by income, even if they're working class by education. And the Democrats still do, you know, especially when you factor in minorities with people a little further down the income ladder. So the working class, however you define it, is still very much contested in American life. It's not that Republicans are consolidating it. It's that they, you know, you can see how they might consolidate it. And then to whether it's possible, I mean, I think that there, I think the union question is this sort of, it is this sort of permanent stumbling block to a lot of what culturally conservative populists imagine themselves to be doing. It is really, it's both hard to see how you reinvigorate unions generally, and it's even harder to see how the Republican Party becomes the vehicle for doing that. And, you know, the labor union really did play this distinctive sort of socially conservative wage boosting role in American life for a long time that is, you know, the a sort of institutional expression of what conservative populists say they want. The Republican Party, you know, doesn't have an agenda that's, you know, pro-union and isn't likely to gain one anytime soon. And I should caveat that there are people engaged in conservative populism, Orrin Cass and others, who have, you know, tried to figure out what a conservative pro-union agenda would look like. And you even had figures like Marco Rubio sort of make gestures in that direction. But it's, you know, we're a long way from that, I think, being a plausible Republican policy agenda, as, you know, as so. That said, I'm maybe less skeptical of sort of an industrial policy agenda than you are, Sam. I think there is a way in which sort of support for domestic industry in various forms could help Republican populists sort of square the circle between, like, you know, well, how do we maintain our donor base while, you know, moving away from certain forms of libertarian thinking on economic policy? Because, you know, we certainly, you know, I think we know that domestic industry likes to be supported. The question is whether it's possible to do it in a way that isn't just, you know, pork and stupidity. That's where the libertarian critique of industrial policy becomes pretty potent. But
so, and I mean, industrial policy in the Trump administration was mostly pork and stupidity. You'd agree with that, right? So between the Opportunity Zones program, which is pork and stupidity on, you know, on times 100, and also some of the trade policy stuff. Question mark.
Yeah, I mean, I can make a kind of contrarian defense of some of the trade policy stuff, but the trade policy stuff, the contrarian defense is that you're trying to change your international playing field vis-a-vis China in a way that could help American workers in the very long term. And in the short term, you need to do some sort of stupid seeming payoffs to farmers to get them to support this trade war. But that's different from, like, having an immediate agenda that helps the working class. But I think if you said the Republican Party of 2024 or 2028 is going to sort of continue Trump's mix of loose money and tight borders, and add to it a more serious industrial policy and a more serious family policy, where you're basically redistributing more money to middle and working class families with children than the Republican Party supports doing right now. I mean, I say that reasonably fleshed out for middle to lower middle class prosperity that would be, you know, we have some of these to sort of Bush era theories, but would have lost some of the, I think, in hindsight, foolishness about, you know, the ownership society, you know, meaning that everybody plays the stock market with their social security and so on. So I think it would be an advance, and I think it would be politically appealing, and it wouldn't be the right-wing version of the socialist revolution, but I think it would make life economically better for a certain kind of American voter who is sort of cross-pressured between Democrats and Republicans right now. So I don't think that's a totally implausible scenario. I'm pessimistic about it actually happening, but I don't think it's a crazy extrapolation from where the party is right now.
So I want to say I loved that column where you stole Tyler Cowen's talking to his id thing.
Oh yeah.
I thought that was quite good. But I want to turn the question I asked of Ross on Sam, which is there's the belief in a like unified left-wing populist Democratic Party seems to also deny the reality that there are other people in the Democratic Party. I thought one of the most interesting like post-election exchanges was the AOC Connor Lamb face-off in the Times. And it was interesting for a couple of reasons. One is the weird obsession with both of them, with the mechanics of electioneering. It's never a good idea when your political principles get into like talking about, you know, deep canvassing and how much money you're spending on Facebook. Anyone who lives in New York City knows the cost of hiring a former political professional to be an actual political principal in Bill de Blasio. It's not a good sign. But I think more broadly, like for the Democrats to win this election, they needed both left-wing turnout and to do well in the suburbs. They needed to keep Connor Lamb and they needed the excitement from, and it just seems to me that a point that one of our former guests, Steve Tellis, made, which is that there's a future of greater factionalism in the Democratic Party, that these are groups that need each other in the sense that neither one of them has any plausible claim to majoritarianism, like to represent a majority of the country, and so they need to be in coalition, but they're going to increasingly hate each other and organize against one another, seems like the most likely future, which is like, just like Connor Lamb and AOC ought to get used to it because they're going to be fighting with one another for a very long time.
Yes, okay, I think that's right. And I think it points to, again, in theory, the other potential strength of a populist-rooted conservatism, which is that you're sort of building from the American middle out. You're basically saying with that kind of conservatism that your base is, you know, sort of genuinely middle-class suburbia, not like upper middle class outside New York, you know, sort of rich suburbs, genuinely middle-class suburbia. And you're basically trying to convince people that, you know, they have a little more in common across racial lines with people whose lives are very similar to them, right? That like the voters Republicans are trying to add who are, you know, Hispanic and African American are voters whose lives are pretty similar to a lot of white people who already vote for the GOP. And that's different from the Democratic challenge where you have with the Democrats, you really have a coalition that is sort of high-low, right? It's like service sector workers, you know, unionized casino workers in Nevada and rich people in Greenwich. And that, you know, that isn't, I mean, racial differences are really important in American life. And so trying to build a pan-racial populism runs into a million problems. But if you just look at people in sort of their everyday, you know, neighborhood dynamics and so on, there is more coherence in the Republican coalition right now and in the potential populist coalition than there is in the AOC, Connor Lamb, Democratic Party.
I mean, I take all those points and, you know, I'm not suggesting a left populism is, would be easy to construct. I think it may have some more economic plausibility. But the other thing I'd say is that, you know, in some regards, we're looking on either side for some, you know, form of realignment politics.
Yeah.
Because we have to get David and the other neoliberals all in one party. And, you know, the trouble is that lately they've dominated both. And, you know,
I think,
good for you, David, but please don't take AOC's name in vain. Along the way. But my thought is that, you know, the suburban issue is going to require some kind of, you know, segregating and titrating, and, you know, whichever party succeeds in, you know, actually creating a realignment working class electorate, you know, some middle class, but, you know, not to the upper reaches of suburban wealth, can win the day. And I just don't see the right as having the economic, kind of policy to get that done in the way the left could, under, you know, not Joe Biden, obviously, but AOC someday. So,
well, part of it is like, to what extent can the left, to what extent can modern monetary theory, right, help the left escape its current trap? Which is the current trap is that the left supports a lot of things that are very popular, but that become substantially less popular if you have to pay for them, right? And this is the, you know, this is sort of the constraint when you have a high-low coalition. It's that, you know, you can get upper middle class voters to vote for liberal and left-wing candidates as long as they don't feel like as a consequence their taxes are going to go way up. And that, you know, to the extent that Democrats could be able to just say, we're going to pay for Medicare for all with, you know, with borrowed money, because borrowed money is really just printed money that is really, you know, only subject to the constraint of inflation. Maybe that actually is the solution. But like right now, you know, you watch the Democratic primary and, you know, Elizabeth Warren's worst moments are when she's trying to explain how she'll pay for her Medicare for all plan. And everyone gives Bernie credit for just saying, yeah, everybody's taxes are going to go up, but you're going to get more money back. But neither of those, I think, clearly together. I'm not sure that, you know, saying you're just putting it on the national credit card holds the whole thing together either. But that seems to be a big part of the dilemma right now, right? That like you have these very left-wing candidates in greater New York who are running on repealing the state and local tax deduction cap, right? Which is a pro upper middle class economic policy. Like, you know, you have this sort of, you have this sense, the upper middle class suburban part of the Democratic coalition inevitably exerts a sort of anti-populist pull on Democratic economic policy.
Yeah. So I think that was really insightful. And I think that some of the most interesting election results, which were subnational ones, kind of back up your story there, that you saw in California, that California does better for Biden than it did for Hillary. But you see in their initiatives a kind of pretty wholesale rejection of certain left, both cultural and taxing. So affirmative action goes down. The Uber thing passes. So the kind of left labor law gets rejected. A big tax increase on big business loses. You see in Illinois a defeat of progressive income taxes. And interestingly, by the way, kind of going the other direction, you see an increase in progressive income taxes in Arizona. But you do see in these kind of Democratic bastions a less than thoroughgoing embrace of traditional tax and spend liberalism and even regulatory liberalism. And I think there are a couple things that are interesting. One is the point you're making, which is that it suggests a little more ambivalence in the heart of the Democratic Party about some of these things than some parts of the Democratic Party would believe there to be. And the second thing is that it highlights something that I think is coming down the pike and is going to be a major issue in the next couple of years, which is you have a number of states that are going to be, that can't print money because states can't print money, that are going to be broke. And I think Illinois, which had balanced its budget on the back of two propositions, one is that they're going to pass this new progressive income tax, and the other is they're going to get a giant amount of federal aid, both of which seem less likely after the election than they did before, will leave states without this option of just printing money because states can't print money and have to keep balanced budgets in a very precarious political place, and that this may be a major political story going forward, unless the Democrats and Republicans, or if the Democrats somehow take the Senate, are able to just make the money printer go brr and send it all to the states. So I think two things, looking at state elections or state initiative elections, more accurately, that kind of help flesh out that point you just made, Ross, are one is there's like a lot more dissension when you go down into Democratic jurisdictions and see what their voter preferences are on high-level kind of high-profile initiatives. And then secondly, the consequence of that is going to be quite dire for a number of these jurisdictions, Illinois, the Metropolitan Transit Authority in New York, and a few other things, unless your proposed solution, the money printer solution, is adopted in wild and full.
The dissension point is the realignment point. The Democratic coalition is still includes a lot of wealthy suburbanite neoliberals.
More
than on the other side.
More than 2016 or 2012.
Well, I think some of them are soft, and you know, they migrate, you know, between the parties historically. And because they follow their interests. And right now, you know, they many voted against Trump in many suburbs, but that's not set in stone. And certainly realignment could expel them. And, you know, you can all be one happy family in one party.
But really, I think the Moyne view should be that the hope is not to expel all of them so much as to convert some of them, right? That, like, you know, sure. You already have a reality where socialism is popular in a population that would have been primed for neoliberalism when I was a teenager, right? So, like, people who graduate from, you know, prominent four-year colleges and go to live in major urban centers have ended up being socialists because they feel that their economic lot is just much more precarious than it should be in all of these ways, right? So the one theory of how globalization, various other forces extend that precarity to to slightly older suburbanites, who therefore become more interested in the sort of socialism's upper middle class carrots, if you will, right? You know, student loan forgiveness, free college, these kinds of things that are sort of handouts for the privileged but precarious, right? Like that, I think that was part of the theory of the Warren campaign, certainly. Like, her left-wing politics clearly offered a lot to her professional class base. They weren't, you know, they weren't just voting against their economic interests when they supported her. But putting that all together with a more blue-collar friendly agenda, you know, it costs a lot of money, right? But since we were talking about the core impediment to a right-wing populism that actually builds an American majority is the difficulty in terms of structures and incentives and donor base and so on in getting the right to favor more economic redistribution. I mean, the core obstacle to the left is culture, right? It's like figuring out how do you disassociate yourself at least a tiny bit from cultural liberalism, right? In order to win more working class votes.
So one thing,
and that seems pretty hard.
One thing I found about, I agree with that. One thing I would say about Sam's view that the neoliberals dominate both parties in all ways, it reminds me of being on this podcast and working with Sam reminds me of a joke about Jews in the 1930s, where two Jews are meeting in the 1930s in Germany, and one is reading the Nazi paper and the other one's reading the Yiddish paper. And the one reading the Yiddish paper says, "How can you read that trash?" And the one reading the Nazi paper says, "Well, if I read your paper, we're getting killed, we're getting murdered. If I read this paper, we run the world." I feel the same way about working with Sam on this front. My cultural dominance is nowhere greater than in Sam's head. So
absolutely. Well, the truth hurts, and me most of all. All right. So as a last question, Ross, you know, I want to indict you as an inconsistent critic of juristocracy, you know, because I thought we were on the same team for a while there. You know, I and some others on the left, you know, maybe belatedly in their case, were kind of, you know, waking up to the reality that the Supreme Court had exercised, you know, unaccountable power in ways that conservatives denounced for decades. And that, you know, in most notably, I think after, you know, turncoat Neil Gorsuch decided this statutory case around Title VII, you wrote about very powerfully, but then you got Amy Coney Barrett. And so, you know, I'm wondering, is your outlook in the next, you know, 4 years, notwithstanding the retention of the Senate, going to be, well, we're expectantly, you know, awaiting the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade? That's good. It will also do a lot of neoliberal and other things, but never mind. And we can worry that, you know, you're very, you know, invigorating critiques of governing through the judiciary will will melt away simply because that's where conservative power is most strongly established. Am I wrong to worry?
I think it will depend on, you know, what the cases are right before before the Supreme Court. But, you know, I mean, like everyone, I will be tempted to endorse juristocracy when juristocracy endorses my policy preferences, right?
And I never do that.
So. No, right. Exactly. You're the last.
Never hypocritical.
But and it's, you know, I have a sort of out because the key, you know, the key thing as a pro-lifer that I want the courts to do is overturn Roe, which I think is an act against juristocracy because it returns the abortion debate to the democratic process. So in that core issue, I get to have my cake and eat it too. I mean, I guess my basic view is that I think that this sort of the neoliberal of juristocracy has at least up till now been more, more tinkering than sweeping, which is, you know, that the court has been sort of center right on economic questions, but has never gone all the way to Lochnerian attacks on the administrative state. And I can promise that if it went all the way to those kind of attacks, I would be against it. Now, again, that's easy for me to say because I'm more of a populist than a libertarian, right? So I have a hard time thinking of really prominent cases where I would want the courts to be sort of juristocratic and just sort of impose my policy preferences, right? So like even, you know, like, you know, take something sort of where I have extreme social conservative views, so to speak, right? The prohibition of pornography. It's very unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to, you know, implement a nationwide ban on pornography. It is maybe fractionally possible that the Supreme Court would open the way a little more to, you know, sort of legislative decency, to decency legislation, if you will. That too would be a blow against juristocracy from my perspective, right? That, like, to me, existing high court jurisprudence on pornography is itself a sort of judicial imposition. I guess the closest you could get is on some religious liberty questions.
Correct. Masterpiece Cake Shop, this the distortion of the First Amendment as a shield that Christians can invoke against otherwise applicable anti-discrimination law.
That turns on statutory interpretation on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, where I think the court's interpretation. This is where my principles start to thin a tiny bit. I basically can see both sides of the RFRA interpretation debates. And so to the extent that I can, I don't mind having the court come down on the side that I think errs on the side of religious liberty. But that's probably the area where I'm most likely to be seen by you as a fair weather anti-juristocrat or a turncoat or something. Like, I won't be sorry if and when the court overrules the state of Pennsylvania's attempts to shut down Catholic adoption agencies, right? Because they won't place kids with same-sex couples. Like, I'll be happy when the court does that, and that's a little bit juristocratic by some definitions. So yeah, that's the closest you get. But I mean, I think that on some of the bigger cases where the Roberts Court has intervened, like, I think it would be a mistake for the Roberts Barrett Court to get rid of affirmative action, even though I think that there's a reasonable sort of judicial argument that they should. I think it would be too much judicial fiat on a vexing and live kind of racial and culture war debate. So that would be an example of somewhere where I think the court might be quite likely to do something that, you know, would have a reasonable case behind it, but I think it should stay its hand for reasons of juristocracy being bad.
Well,
especially when, you know, Californians are voting, you know, out affirmative action by majority rule, and, you know, you could expect that to you know, that trend to continue without the courts.
Yeah, yeah. Affirmative action is clearly a case where conservatives have, you know, conservative politicians don't want to touch the issue anymore. So the battle tends to be fought in the courts and in referenda. And I'd rather that it was fought in referenda than in the courts.
Well, I thought this was super fun. So I want to say thank you to Ross Douthat for joining us on this episode. And it was great. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Ross. You're very welcome. Congratulations on joining the podcasting world. I hope you guys are really enjoying yourselves so far.
We are.
Well,
who
knows how long it will last, but you know.
We are deeply unprofessional. Deeply unprofessional.
True of everything these days.
Thanks for joining our fledgling experiment.
Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, Ross.
All right. Thanks, guys.